Hi, good morning, and thank you all for joining us today to hear Rajiv Venkayev from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS, the Global Health Policy Center. First of all, sorry for the delay, slight delay in getting ourselves started here this morning. A couple of quick announcements. Paula Dobriansky will be speaking here on the 17th, which is a Friday, 17th. Of April, 3 p.m., with a predominant focus on women's issues and special reference to Afghanistan and the work that she began there with women's groups during the Bush administration. So please join us for that. We will be launching on April 21st at 10 a.m. here at CSIS B1. We'll be launching a major commission on a smart global health policy, co-chaired by Helene Gayle and Admiral Fallon and a number of other prominent individuals who've committed to that effort. We'll be sending out the formal notice to you, to all of you, on that launch on the 21st of April at 10 a.m., so please join us for that. We're delighted that Rajiv is with us this morning. The focus here is to examine strategies for improving the delivery of essential health technologies and services in developing countries. This is a critical area, and as many of you know, it's just one of the toughest and one which the foundation has elevated as a priority with his recruitment to Seattle, where he serves as a director of health delivery. His focus there is on late-stage development of health technologies and interventions and the means to expand access to health solutions in the developing world. And here we get into this discussion around affordability and access and systems for delivery, and what kind of incentives or disincentives enter the picture. Often the solutions, the actual technological solutions for improving health on a mass scale exist, but do not reach those populations that need to be served. And the question is understanding the root causes and what kind of strategies can mitigate the obstacles that are there. Rajiv will be speaking for about 25 minutes, and then we'll move into a more conversational phase and take comments and questions. I want to offer special thanks to Suzanne Brundage and Catherine Streifels for helping organize this session here today. Rajiv is familiar to many of you here. He's a very distinguished service during the Bush years, 2005 to 2008, was Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Biodefense at the White House Homeland Security Council, responsible for policy approaches on bioterrorism and naturally occurring biological threats, such as avian influenza and SARS. Prior to that, he was from 2003 to 2005 as a director for biodefense and health at the Homeland Security Council. 2002-2003, one of 13 White House fellows, where he served for then-Secretary Spencer Abrams at the Department of Energy as an advisor on science and technology. Rajiv is a pulmonary and critical care physician, assistant professor of medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, holds a medical degree from Northeastern Ohio University's College of Medicine. He's kindly agreed to be on our advisory board here for the center and has agreed to be one of the commissioners on this commission that we'll be launching on April 21st. So please join me in welcoming Rajiv Venkayev.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, for that kind introduction. It's great to be back in front of so many familiar faces, so many friends. I do want to extend a special welcome to Secretary Peak from the Department of Veterans Affairs, who's here, as well as Harrison Spencer from the Association of Schools of Public Health. Of course, my former colleague, Ambassador Lang, and now my new coworker. He joined today at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as an individual who's going to be leading our government outreach efforts in the developing world, principally in Africa, but also South Asia. We're delighted to have Ambassador Lang join the team. Thank you, Steve, and thanks to CSIS and the program for giving me an opportunity to provide a perspective from the Gates Foundation on delivery. Let me begin by giving a little bit of perspective on how the foundation thinks about health. First of all, we're driven by two principles. Number one, that all lives have equal value, and secondly, that to whom much has been given, much is expected. When it comes to health, the way we translate that is to say, as a principle, that your life expectancy or likelihood of getting past the first day or first month or first 2 years of birth should not be determined by the zip code of your birth. So that's a practical way to think about the way we think about inequity in health outcomes. Now, there are certain things that are in scope for the Gates Foundation, and there are other things that are not. And this succinctly summarizes it. We focus on preventable diseases of the poor, principally. And those are nearly wholly related to communicable diseases, although we also look at ways to improve nutrition and improve the care of mothers who are delivering babies and neonatal care, and tackle conditions that aren't communicable diseases per se, but they are preventable causes of morbidity and mortality amongst mothers and children. We do not cover non-communicable diseases. We don't do work in heart disease or hypertension or diabetes or asthma. That is not to say that those are not important contributors to illness and suffering in the developing world. They certainly are. And as you can see by this pie chart, they're not insignificant in size and scope. However, in the case of non-communicable diseases, our belief is that there are a number of private sector entities and governments that are working very, very hard to tackle the scientific challenges and to build new tools to address those problems in the rich world, in the developed world, and the hope would be that as those tools are developed that we can work on ways or collectively to make those tools accessible to poor populations. So we principally focus on diseases that are not or have not historically been addressed by others. Now, this is a way of representing the inequity that I was mentioning earlier. If you look at the burden of infant mortality, neonatal mortality, the burden of maternal mortality, the 500,000 women that die during childbirth every year, the vast majority of that burden of illness resides in the developing world. And this is a way of graphically representing that burden of disease. This is infant mortality. You see very similar graphs if you look at neonatal mortality, under five mortality, or maternal mortality. In the case of malnutrition, there is a little bit of a further distortion. India, which accounts for about 22% of the world's population, actually accounts for about 40% of the world's malnutrition. Another way to represent this that is quite striking is to look at those conditions that I just told you that the Gates Foundation focuses on, those preventable causes of suffering and death, and look at the proportion of disability-adjusted life years that reside in each of the highest burden countries. And if you look at the cumulative total with regard to burden of disease as represented by DALYS, you can see that it only takes you six countries to get to about 50% of the global burden of disease related to these conditions as represented by DALYS. That's remarkable. Now, there are a number of tools that are currently available to tackle these diseases. We are accustomed to them. We take them for granted here in this country. Things like vaccinations against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, vaccinations against Haemophilus influenza B, antibiotics if you have pneumonia or a skin infection and you have to go to the hospital, getting basic hospital care just by making a phone call or stopping by an urgent care. Those technologies are not available to many populations in the developing world today. If you take that as a baseline and then look at the challenge of that we have ahead of us with regard to new technologies coming down the pike, and here you can see a sampling of technologies that the Gates Foundation is either funding or we are actively supporting the efforts of other partners to bring these technologies to the point of proof of concept and then ultimately registration and launch, you can see that if we don't address the barriers to uptake of existing technologies, we're going to have a big pileup of new technologies that are never going to get to the populations that need them. Here's another way of representing the problem. This is a graph that illustrates how long it has taken for global health interventions to get to the populations that need them in the developing world. If you look at, for instance, the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, here on the x-axis you can see the number of years since the product was available prior to introduction. So the graph here, this yellow line that you see here, represents uptake in the developing world. And you can see here in the case of the Hib vaccine, Haemophilus influenza B vaccine, it was about 10 years before you started to see uptake in low and middle income countries. The y-axis here represents the proportion of coverage of the populations that actually need to receive, in this case, the vaccine. Compare that to a typical drug launch in the United States. Here in the U.S., we take the infrastructure for granted. We take marketing for granted. We take demand amongst providers and the population for granted. The pharmaceutical company just has to do fairly modest things in order to get providers and consumers to want their products. And we have an infrastructure in place to get new products to people very quickly. That is anything but the case when you look at technologies and tools for the developing world. Hepatitis B vaccine became available about 27 years ago. It is still not introduced in India, and about a third of populations in sub-Saharan Africa don't have access to hepatitis B vaccine. DOTS, or Directly Observed Therapy Short Course for Tuberculosis, was taken up relatively quickly, but realized that with DOTS, it was really just a protocol that you would use to administer existing drugs for a prescribed period of time to individuals who have tuberculosis. DOTS was not a new drug, per se. It was a new combination of drugs, which is why you saw relatively swift uptake. Now, one line that I'm going to come back to is a line that you see here with skilled birth attendants. The Safe Motherhood Initiative was an advocacy effort that was launched in the late 80s for a variety of reasons, including lack of agreement amongst the technical experts as to what works and what doesn't work and what the technical folks ought to get behind versus what they should not to address maternal mortality. We've seen a very poor uptake on the skilled birth attendant side. The advocacy piece and disagreement amongst technical experts is just one piece of that problem, though. The reality is that in order to get mothers in front of people who know how to deliver babies and deal with complications, you have to have a health system. It's more than just having a vaccination campaign, say, with the polio vaccine that reaches out to a community. You actually have to have an infrastructure. You have to have trained health workers. And you need to have medications to deal with those complications as they arise. So the reasons for the late, slow, low uptake of these technologies vary from product to product. But that doesn't matter. The reasons don't matter. The outcome is what matters. The last point I'll make about this graph is that if you look at where each of these lines tops out, in many cases it's right around 50 to 60%. That's a problem. Not just because that's 40 to 50% of the population that's not covered. That 40 to 50% represents the poorest of poor populations in the developing world, the hardest to reach populations. And that, in fact, is the population that the Gates Foundation cares most about. And so unless we tackle these burdens, or I should say these barriers to delivery of technologies, we are going to forever face the same problem that we're facing now with existing technologies, and that is that poor populations are not going to accrue the benefits that we project or aspire to. To put a finer point on this, I'll show you a graph that was developed by the rotavirus ADIP, which is the Accelerated Development and Introduction Program, or actually in this case it was called the Rotavirus Vaccine Program. The ADIPs are programs that Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, established in order to provide advocacy support, to provide policymakers with technical assistance to make decisions to introduce new vaccines, essentially entities that would do everything possible to make sure new technologies, once they became available, made it to countries as quickly as possible. The rotavirus vaccine program projected what the uptake curve would look like globally if you didn't make any intervention on the data gathering side, surveillance side, working with WHO and the policymakers there to accelerate that uptake. And then they plotted out or modeled a graph of uptake if you made those interventions to accelerate the uptake. The bottom line is that if you take steps to make sure that regulatory approval happens sooner, policy recommendations happen sooner, countries make a decision to adopt and introduce the vaccine sooner, you can accelerate that timeline by a few years, and you can actually translate that to lives saved. It's pretty unequivocal that if you can get more kids vaccinated sooner with the new vaccine, this is not rocket science, you're going to save lives. And you can see here that the incremental benefit is 1.4 million children's lives saved. So this is a pretty important slide, and it happens to be the one that you can't read. This is the result of an analysis that we did last year as a delivery team was getting off the ground at the Gates Foundation to understand what barriers lead to this late, slow, low, and inequitable uptake of products. I'm going to read to you the key points here, so don't worry about squinting. We've identified five barriers that we think are critical to address. The first is the failure to adapt interventions to target populations and effectively plan for the launch of that product. If you think about traditional drug development, every drug has what we call a target product profile that drives decision-making at every stage of development. How many times does a drug have to be administered? Does it require refrigeration? Does it have any side effects? Those are all things that are developed well in advance by the pharmaceutical company in order to ensure that they take away the barriers to consumer preferences or provider preferences so that you have the maximal uptake of the product once it's launched. In the case of technologies targeting the developing world, this is kind of a new game. There are some nonprofit entities that are working in the space. There are some relatively new biotechs in the space that are not really facile in developing a target product profile for the developing world. So, for example, if you have a vaccine that requires a cold chain, requires refrigeration, but it happens to be a high-volume vaccine, that's going to be a problem from a capacity standpoint. Many places in Africa do have an effective cold chain, but the refrigeration units may not have the space to accommodate a high-volume vaccine in the numbers of doses that you need to immunize the population. You have to think through that requirement as you're developing the vaccine so you can make a go-no-go decision to forego that higher volume vaccine in the development process if you actually want it to get to the population you care about.
Now, promomycin is a drug that's used to treat visceral leishmaniasis, but it's an injectable drug that needs to be administered once a day for 21 days to patients with VL. You can just imagine how difficult that is to deliver to populations in rural India where VL is endemic.
Had a target product profile been established, or an appropriate target product profile, earlier in the development process, we might not have had a drug with those attributes. So failure to tailor the product to the environment is an important barrier. Also, planning for the launch, identifying consumer needs and preferences, identifying the demand that you anticipate so that companies can appropriately plan in the course of launch preparations is also important. The second barrier are suboptimal and slow policy processes at the global and local level. You may be aware that new products that come online for the developing world often need to have technical approval or policy recommendations by a global body, such as the SAGE at the WHO, the group of experts that evaluate, let's take as an example, rotavirus vaccine. The SAGE panel looked at the rotavirus vaccine and, based on the available evidence on its effectiveness in Latin America, recommended that the rotavirus vaccine be used in Latin American nations. There was not enough evidence from African and South Asian nations to make that same recommendation, and so that policy recommendation was delayed, and that's resulting in a delay of a few years of introduction of rotavirus vaccine in South Asia, principally because people didn't think through the evidence that was going to be necessary to inform a policy recommendation. Similar to the global recommendation, many countries in the developing world have a policy body that has to look at that product and decide whether it's appropriate for that for the population within their borders. Think about the American Committee for Immunization Practices, the ACIP, or the National Vaccine Advisory Committee in this country. Those are two committees that weigh in with a recommendation on whether or not we should introduce new vaccines for children. Similar bodies exist at the country level. And so anything that we can do to speed the decision-making at the global and country level will address this barrier. Regulatory issues present similar barriers. And so there are global regulatory entities like the WHO pre-qualification process and the FDA and EMEA, which are often considered to be sort of the gold standard for regulatory approval. Ensuring that they have the bandwidth and the wherewithal and the willingness to review products that are not designed for Europe or America is very important. And so that's another barrier that one needs to tackle if you want to establish regulatory approval at the global level swiftly. Similarly, at the country level, there are regulatory authorities that look at the global bodies before making a decision as to whether a drug is going to be approved for use in their country. The third barrier is financial barriers to access, and of course, this is about who's going to pay for the vaccine or drug. We have a number of entities that are working on this or that are providing resources for the procurement of these commodities. The Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, UNITAID. These are all international finance instruments that donors can contribute to in order to procure commodities for the developing world. But similarly, we need to think through the financing mechanisms at the country level. If you're financing health services in such a way that is not incentivizing the right behavior by the actors in the system, that can lead to suboptimal productivity, to put it mildly. And we think that financing is an important, at the country level, is an important lever that we need to look at to improve efficiency of the spend of funds in countries. The fourth area we'll euphemistically call delivery platforms here. This is the equivalent of what many would call health systems. So this is the workforce, the infrastructure, the supply chain, the data systems, all of the very complex stuff at the country level that's necessary to get products and services to people. There's a lot of attention being paid to health systems right now. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But this is a very, very important barrier that we think needs to be tackled in order to get life-saving and life-prolonging services to people. And then finally, we cite leadership and governance as a critical issue in order to ensure that these technologies get to the people that need them. This is about having champions for new technologies and new products. It's about having effective ministers of health and managers throughout the health system in a country. Governance is a critically important element of the equation, and it's one of the hardest pieces of the puzzle to crack. So the theory of change here is that in order to see improvements in coverage, improvements in the rate of uptake of life-saving technologies, you need to tackle all of these barriers. It's not sufficient to tackle any single one of them, because if you do, there's likely to be another bottleneck that gets in the way of achieving your objective. Now, I've made it sound like we're all about individual products, and that is how the Gates Foundation comes at this problem. When we think about delivery, we're not thinking about the vast universe of things that one needs to do to improve delivery. We're beginning by thinking through the barriers to uptake of the products and services that we support, that we know will save lives if they get to people. But the reality is that we operate in a very complex health system. And just to give you an example of how complicated it could be, if your goal is to drive down the incidence, or let's say mortality in this case, of pneumonia, the pneumococcal vaccine is just one tool in your toolkit. If you really want to have an impact on pneumonia mortality, the pneumococcal vaccine is not going to be enough. Even if you take one of the two new pneumococcal vaccines that are coming out in the near future, you need to tackle a whole host of other agents that are responsible for pneumonia. You need to tackle nutrition. Nutrition is responsible for about 50% of under 5 deaths. I should say it's a contributor to about 50% of under 5 deaths that occur globally in the developing world. And then you need to have a system in place to get things like antibiotics and oxygen to children that come in with pneumonia. Those are complex interventions to deliver to people. It's relatively straightforward to get a vaccine to a population. It's much more complicated to put a system in place that gets antibiotics and oxygen to a properly diagnosed child anywhere in the developing world. To make it even more complicated, let's talk about the causes of death in mothers and children around childbirth. I don't think I mentioned this at the beginning, but every year 10 million children under the age of 5 die of preventable diseases. 4 million of those children die in the first month. 2 million of those kids die in the first day of life. And that doesn't account for 3 million stillborn children every year. Again, nearly all in the developing world. If you look at the causes of neonatal mortality, it's preterm birth, it's sepsis or infection, and it's asphyxia during birth. 500,000 women die during childbirth every year. If you look at the causes of that mortality, it's postpartum hemorrhage, eclampsia, and infections, and then obstructed labor. You can't vaccinate for this stuff. You can't get a product to somebody and expect them to be protected from any of the things that I just mentioned. You need to have a health system that tackles those problems. And to give you a sense of the complexity, this is what we're talking about. You don't need to read everything on the left here. This is the set of interventions that we think you need to deliver to a mother during the 9 months that she's carrying a baby. immediately during the time of birth and for the 2 years after birth to ensure that that child has all the vaccinations that he or she needs. This is what you need to do to tackle the burden of maternal and child mortality. And in order to do this, you need to have a health system in place. Which brings me to my last point, and that is that health systems have increasingly received attention in the global health community as being an essential element of this equation. There is an ongoing debate that is playing out in very expensive hotels all across Europe between people who think that disease-focused programs have done about as much harm as they have good. That's the feeling in some quarters. There are others who feel that the disease-focused programs like PEPFAR, like what the Global Fund has done, like the President's Malaria Initiative, have done good things, but we need to now reshape them so that they address these fundamental health systems constraints. I think if you look at the Gates Foundation, while we're still working through our position on this, our view on this is that we've made a tremendous amount of progress that we probably would not have made were it not for the focus on HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, childhood immunization, but that there almost certainly is room now to think about how those programs are designed, to design them even more smartly, if you will, to address these constraints that exist in health systems. The rationale that folks have appropriately highlighted are that while we've made progress against HIV, TB, and malaria, which are captured under Millennium Development Goal number 6, Millennium Development Goal number 4, which is under 5 mortality, and 5, which is maternal mortality, have lagged. The other issue that folks have highlighted is the fact that there are a lot of donors out there placing a lot of requirements on countries that are receiving their resources, and that we need to do a better job of harmonizing the use of those funds against the country's health system plan. So these are some of the reasons that folks have highlighted the need to focus on health systems. There are a number of efforts. I'm actually, in the interest of time, not going to go into these. I can discuss them in more detail during the Q&A. But suffice it to say that there is a lot of attention and energy being applied to this issue of how can we be smarter about the way we direct our disease-focused funds, and then is there an opportunity to generate new resources for health system strengthening in a way that actually gets us the results that we aspire to? Let me close by talking about some success stories. So I've painted a pretty difficult picture about the health of mothers and children in the developing world. And I think that's necessary because we are a long way from being able to declare anything close to success when it comes to these preventable causes of illness and death. But there are some real success stories. We were in Ghana about a year ago and went to a Carter Center effort in northern Ghana that is tackling guinea worm. So for those of you that don't know about guinea worm is a worm that you can find in contaminated water. It actually is it's in its larva form in water. It's eaten up by water fleas, which are microscopic. The fleas in the water supply are consumed by individuals who use these pools of standing water or lakes. And then once in the gut, the worm hatches or grows and then burrows its way through the skin, through the viscera to the skin, usually in the lower extremities, and looks for water, looks to get back to a water source. Extraordinarily painful. Kids are the ones that are most commonly infected with guinea worm. Once this worm starts sticking its head outside the skin, the kid has a lot of itching and a lot of pain and immediately runs to put the extremity in water. The worm leaves the body and releases a flood of new larvae, which are then taken up by fleas and then consumed again. And that's the life cycle of guinea worm. Now, back in the mid-1980s, there were about 3.5 million cases of guinea worm around the globe in about 20 countries. The Carter Center along the way decided it was going to tackle guinea worm. And I can tell you that as of today, guinea worm has been reduced to about 6 countries and fewer than 5,000 cases in 2008. The year before it was 10,000 cases. We're making huge progress against guinea worm. And there's a very good chance that due to the Carter Center's efforts and those of others, that we're going to eradicate guinea worm at some point in the future. Polio is another great success story. In 1988, 350,000 cases of polio in 125 countries. We're now down to 4 countries where we've identified polio, and the numbers of cases is less than 1,700 in those 4 places: India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult to make the last mile in polio. It's going to take a lot of resources. But if we can make polio or guinea worm the second disease to be eradicated off the face of this earth after smallpox, that will be a huge success for global health. And I think we're going to get there. The final one that I'll mention is Gavi. Gavi has vaccinated 51 million children with DTP3, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, 3 doses. And about 213 million kids have received vaccines of underutilized vaccines, hepatitis B, yellow fever, Hib. And Gavi, I should say the WHO's projections of the impact of Gavi efforts so that we will avert 3.5 million deaths of children. So these are all things that have happened in the past few years, and I think they're very, very exciting. And the point is that if you tailor your investments properly, you can have a huge impact. But all of the things that I've been talking about when it comes to success stories are delivery success stories. We have the tools. It's a matter of getting those tools to the people that need them. So with that, I hope that was a useful first cut at how the Gates Foundation thinks about global health delivery, and I'll be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Rajiv. We're going to request some comment and questions. We'll pull together several people here, and there's a lot of hands going up, so be patient. We'll do a couple of rounds of this. One question I would like you to speak to, Rajiv, off the bat, is how the global economic crisis impacts these questions and whether this raises another level of uncertainty or whether it creates opportunities to refocus folks, and how that is playing through this broad agenda that you just very eloquently walked us through. So everyone, if you could just stand up. There's a microphone that will come to you. Please identify yourself, and we'll take three interventions really rapidly.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Serpa from AD. Would like to ask you, how do you see in the platform, in the health system, utilizing more of the community health workers to deliver the services as Dr. Abhay Bang did for pneumonia in India?
So, okay, I'll wait.
And we'll take two more, right next to you, and then this woman right here.
Hi, Susie Peel, working in low literacy and its sphere. If you added to your initial map the low literacy, it would map perfectly with all the different diseases that you were focusing on. I was wondering whether there's also an integration of considerations about maternal education while we're waiting to improve systems. In other words, getting messages out there very, very quickly in non-print fashions through cell phones, speaking books, other methodologies.
Thank you. Right here. And we'll come back to you, Rajiv.
Hi, I'm Sejal Mistry from the Fogarty International Center at the NIH. And my question is, throughout your talk, you talked about addressing the barriers to implementation in old and new technologies. But a lot of these barriers vary by context, country, and disease. So what role do you see for health system strengthening research, operational research, or implementation science?
Great. Well, let me...
Yeah, why don't we come back to
Okay,
you?
Sure. Well, thank you for those questions. With regard to the global economic crisis, there's no question that has affected the Gates Foundation like it's affected everyone else. We've seen a significant decrement in the value of our endowment, which I'll remind you is comprised both of the gifts from Bill and Melinda Gates, but also gift from Warren Buffett. And so we've had to take a careful look as to the grants that we're making and take a long and hard look as to whether we can continue the ramp up and payout that we've had the benefit of achieving over the past few years. And the decision for 2009 was that we would continue to increase our annual payout in grants. But instead of increasing that by approximately 20%, as we had planned, we're increasing it by about 7%. And that, I think, is unusual in this environment. And I'm happy to say that we haven't had to pull back. Now, what we have had to do is refocus on the conditions that I mentioned and the delivery, in my case, the delivery needs of the products that we have in our portfolio or those that we have adopted, if you will. There is a real concern that we and others have about what donors are going to do. Mm-hmm. Countries, bilaterals, have made commitments to official development assistance, and we're already seeing countries pull back from those commitments that have been made. It is more important now than ever to maintain these commitments. The impact of pulling back funding to the developing world at this time is, frankly, just catastrophic. And so we're doing everything we can to convince donors and to convince donors to convince other donors that they need to maintain those commitments, principally amongst the G8 nations, but others as well. And then the last point I would make on this is that this does represent an opportunity for us to look carefully as to what types of investment lead to the greatest impact in health. And so the efficiency of the spend, not just at the global level, but also encouraging ministers of health in the developing world to think carefully about how to maximize productivity of the health workers and institutions in their health system. Let me briefly touch on the three other questions that were asked. So I think there's a question about community health workers and their role. And was that specifically targeted? Did you mention India in particular?
In pneumonia, but in general.
So there is a concept that some of you may be familiar with known as task shifting. And task shifting means that you take services that would normally be provided by a relatively skilled provider, such as a nurse or even a physician, and look at whether that service can be provided by a lower-trained cadre of health workers, such as a community health worker. And I think there absolutely is a lot of interest in using community health workers to provide more services than they have. The one example I would use is the provision of misoprostol for postpartum hemorrhage. So oxytocin, which is an intravenous drug or a drug that you can give, intravenous, I think subcutaneously as well, is something that typically requires a skilled provider. Misoprostol, though, is a pill. And while it's not quite as effective as oxytocin, if you can give it in an environment where you can't give oxytocin, then it's something that you definitely want to use to mitigate the likelihood of postpartum hemorrhage leading to morbidity and mortality. There may be an opportunity for community health workers to deliver misoprostol to women during childbirth, but it does require some training amongst those community health workers because it is not without complications if used improperly. So we absolutely are interested in exploring ways to use community health workers to expand the reach of the health system. With regard to literacy, there is no question that education of consumers is very, very important, and you have to use whatever means is most likely to reach them. With the populations that we target, cell phones, unfortunately, are not often an avenue that we can pursue, but there are other ways that don't require literacy amongst the consumer, amongst the mother or the family, that you can get messages out there. And we call that behavior change communication, if you will, but it's a way of educating say mothers about the options available to them, but also generating demand for better services from the public sector that is supposed to be providing these high quality services. If you can work on improving both the supply side but also incentivize or stimulate the supply side to do better because consumers are demanding it, that is more likely to get you to your objective than just working on one side or the other. And then with regard to implementation science or operations research, this is critically important. The idea here is that you can have an intervention that's efficacious, that in a clinical trial equivalent, it's been shown to work against a condition, but in a very controlled setting. But then once you get it out into the field, it doesn't work. So it's efficacious, but it's not effective in practice. I don't think many people have the patience to wait to have a lot of studies done on the operational or operations research side, but I do think that we can design our programs in a way that allows us to maximize the data collection so that we can glean lessons from every one of our disease control efforts that is underway. So that
you're gathering data in real time. It may not be the same as having a randomized controlled trial to inform future programs, but it is data nonetheless and sufficient to allow you to at least guide you in your future decision making.
Thank you. Ken Bernard, and then we have this gentleman over here.
Hi. A question you hinted at, but I have ongoing concern about, is the difference between vertical programs and the horizontal programs that take advantage of health systems. I know the Institute of Medicine recently recommended that we're ignoring chronic disease, et cetera, because it causes most of the deaths in developing countries, et cetera. Maybe Steve's commission will look more detailed into this. My concern is that guinea worm, polio, smallpox, DPT-3, Gavi, maternal child health, et cetera, are all vertical programs or quasi-vertical programs that have all been successful. The programs that deal with health sector development have a tendency to be expensive, difficult, corrupt, politically almost impossible to move money around for one reason or another. And hard to measure outcomes in political time, 2 or 4 years. If you can't measure an outcome in a short period of time, the funding has a tendency to disappear. How does Gates see moving in the direction of working in the health systems such that they actually don't fall into the pit of previous health systems work?
Hold on that. This woman right here and then the gentleman over. Yes, ma'am. Right behind you there.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Most of the diseases in developing countries are driven by poverty. And while I'm aware that not one agency cannot respond to all issues, but I would like to know how the Gates Foundation is also investing in terms of helping people to overcome poverty so that, you know, they can have sustainable responses to specific diseases instead of just, you know, you address it today. Tomorrow, the conditions, the poor conditions generate the same problem. And so you have to keep on investing to remove the problem that could be easily removed by helping people out of poverty.
Thank you. The gentleman over by the wall there.
Dr. Prakash Nalipalli, Catholic Relief Services. As you may be aware, sir, almost 50 to 60% of the healthcare is provided by faith-based organizations, especially in Africa. What role do you think they have in strengthening the health system, and what areas should they? Do you think they should be focusing on? Thank you.
Thank you. Come back to you.
Okay. Well, let me begin with the question posed by the Honorable Admiral Ken Bernard, retired, my former boss. So the issue is whether we risk going down a black hole by investing in health systems. I think that's the bottom line. That when you think about Julio Frank, who is now the dean of the School of Public Health at Harvard, likes to talk about the black hole and the black box of health systems. The black box meaning that we don't have a common understanding as to what a health system is comprised of and what the levers are to improve its functioning. And the black hole in terms of the unlimited resources you could invest in inputs, as defined as more health workers, more hospitals and clinics, more drugs, without necessarily have a linkage to the outcomes or outputs of the system. This is a very, very valid question, and I think it's a real concern amongst many groups that are grappling with this issue of what does it mean to generate more resources for health system strengthening. A lot of folks, and I would put myself personally in this category, have concerns that if we call for more resources for health system strengthening without having a clear idea as to how we're going to measure outcomes or outputs of these investments, then we risk squandering a lot of resources and, frankly, a lot of goodwill. The benefit of the vertical or disease-focused programs is that it's relatively easy to link investments to outcomes or outputs and results. That's the benefit.
But of course, there is a potential downside that you distort the way the health system functions. My personal belief, and again, I don't think we as a foundation are yet at our final policy position on this, is that we should look at ways to design those programs more effectively, as I think PEPFAR is looking to do, as Gavi and the Global Fund are thinking about doing, so that these disease-focused investments are taking into account the needs of the broader health system. For the health system strengthening investments, I think we need to be very clear as to what the specific vertical outcomes are that we're looking for. And so this is what Jaime Sepulveda and others have called the diagonal approach, or some modification of it, where you can invest in health systems, but you absolutely make sure that you are tracking maternal mortality, neonatal mortality, malaria incidence, or I should say malaria-related morbidity, HIV-related morbidity, and so on. So, quote-unquote horizontal investments, but with vertical outcomes as a measure of whether you're making progress. With regard to the role of poverty, there's no question that poverty is a critically important driver for all of the health conditions that I've discussed today. It's also true that, as again Julio points out, that better health can lead to wealth. So that there are, this is I'm not going to call it a chicken and egg thing, but these are absolutely interrelated. We have in the Global Development Program at the Gates Foundation a group that is focused on agriculture development, which we think is a very, very important, if not the most important driver of prosperity in the developing world, as well as a group that focuses on financial services for the poor. So thinking of ways to provide savings instruments to the unbanked, as they're sometimes called in the developing world, where there is no instrument that you can, where you can safely save, store resources, or for that matter, get credit in order to begin an enterprise. So we are doing work in that space, in the microfinance space, and then a lot of work in the agriculture development space, because we completely agree that you need to tackle this as well. With regard to CRS, Catholic Relief Services, and the faith-based organizations that are providing services in the developing world, no question that they are critical foundations of the health system in many places. I think that these organizations present an opportunity to try innovative approaches to expanding the reach of the health system. I think that the public sector provision of services, if well designed, can get you so far, but the faith-based organizations, other NGOs, play an important, in some cases critical, supporting role in expanding the reach of that health system. So we are great fans of CRS and organizations like it that are doing work. In fact, I think I was scheduled to meet with CRS last Friday, but we had to postpone because I was traveling.
Thank you. Bob Harrison. Tony and David up front here, Catherine.
Thank you. You mentioned one of the major constraints on sustainability is the need to harmonize foreign assistance coming through ministries of education and governments. Have you thought about the utilization of the OECD and perhaps the development assistance community of the OECD, which has been working on assistance harmonization for some time, as perhaps one of the institutional linkages for this in terms of getting this onto a larger platform and stage?
Thank you. Tony?
Since I'm right here, Tony Carroll. Have you evaluated the potential role of money remittances? They vastly represent a vastly richer pool of financial resources into the developing world. Many of them could be tapped and are not effectively tapped to supply health care for the beneficiaries of diaspora residents in developing countries. I think this has been an overlooked convergence, if you would, in developing and strengthening health systems. I guess by declaration or self-interest, I do work with Farm Access, who's looking at providing health insurance and using remittances.
Right here. We'll come back with another round.
Adam Jones, BRT Management Consultants. You mentioned issues around funding, around delivery, and around the relative inexperience of stakeholders in the space as key constraints on the overall success of just succeeding. There are similar issues in the biodefense arena, especially domestically, but also abroad as well. Also massive investment, namely over $50 billion of the last decade.
Similar issues where?
In the biodefense, domestic and internationally, arena. And I'm wondering if you see potential ways, giving your perspective in both arenas, potential ways to leverage resources that have been committed and to solve problems in infectious disease in general across the board, both man-made and naturally emerging.
Sure. So with regard to harmonization of resources, I can't say that I have been privy to discussions about using the OECD for this. I can tell you that the International Health Partnership launched by Gordon Brown has the objective of achieving the aspirations of what's known as the Paris Declaration, which is harmonization of donor activities in countries. That was launched on the margins of the UN General Assembly about a year and a half ago. And then this past September, Brown announced the high-level task force for innovative financing of health systems for health system strengthening, which is a group that is looking at how to generate resources to fill the resource gaps identified through this International Health Partnership exercise, IHP for short. The IHP exercise is essentially asking countries to come up with a country compact, if you will, that donors sign up to, that ensure that donor funding that's coming into, say, Ethiopia, which was one of the first countries to do this, are, quote, on plan and on budget. So donors are essentially, they have the right of refusal, but if they sign the compact, then they agree to provide essentially unrestricted health sector or budget support in service of the minister's plan. This is very much a work in progress, and I think that there are a couple of issues here. The issues around the credibility of the plan and whether there is a sufficient linkage between the resources coming in and the outcomes or outputs that we know that the donors are going to be looking for and the respective legislatures in country. And then, of course, there's the much bigger question of resource mobilization. The high-level task force has come up with its initial costing of what it's going to take to fill the gaps necessary to achieve MDGs 4, 5, and 6, and they're projecting on the order of $36 to $49 billion a year in 2015. Now, if countries in the developing world achieve the target of committing 15% of their GNI, or I should say government expenditures, to health, and if donors commit across the board 0.7% of their GNI to official development assistance, that shrinks the gap down to about $7 billion a year. But that's a huge if. And I think that, you know, if you're going to try to mobilize that kind of resource, those kind of resources, you need to be able to provide a convincing story to donors that those investments are going to lead to the outcomes and results that they aspire to with their bilateral programs. And so this is a long way of saying that I can't speak to the OECD vehicle, but there are other instruments that are being examined to achieve this harmonization objective. the question of remittances, I have to say that I am, I guess maybe you could clarify, how might one propose to tap into remittances to fund health systems, capacity building, or anything else in the health sector? Are you talking about taxing remittances?
My work with both a large money remittance company, Dahab Shiel, which remits to Ethiopia and Somalia and Sudan, which already has a network, if you would, of remittance agents, and linking that into the delivery of private health care. Okay, for example, in Hargeisa, the Edna Adan Ismail Hospital, which is a privately funded health hospital started maternal but now general delivery, looking at ways in which we can have the members of the Somali diaspora, wherever they be, can remit monies to that, you know, through this network, and in effect ensure members of their family or community let's say $35 or $40 or $75 a year for a schedule of general services, which would be audited and, you know, would conform with the ordinary sort of risk pool management dynamics that you would have in other larger, more sophisticated systems.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. I can't say that that I have, that my group has looked into that. It's possible that the folks on our development side have explored that, but I'll follow up on that when I get back. Just out of, I mean, it actually is a kind of a provocative potential approach to this issue of expanding access, particularly through
it. Work with Ken Barnard,
too. Oh, you did.
We can exchange notes about
The third question was around whether there are potential synergies between biodefense activities and global health activities. I've actually thought a little bit about this, and I do think there may be, and I'll just cite two examples. One is on the manufacturing side. So we in this country are looking to incentivize industry to develop new tools to tackle potential bioterrorism agents and also to develop new tools to address potential pandemic strains or strains of influenza virus with pandemic potential. I have to believe that there are ways to bring those efforts together with our product development needs on the global health side to maximize synergies and, you know, details to be determined. Now, I do think that on the cost of goods sold side, I've absolutely seen technologies in the pandemic arena and in the broader biodefense arena that I think could be very relevant to helping us to drive down the cost of some of the vaccines that we're talking about that are coming down the pike targeting diseases of the poor. And so it's in nascent stages, but we are looking at ways to capitalize on those technologies and applying them to global health considerations or needs. The other opportunity, I think, is on the surveillance side. One of the principal drivers for decision-making in countries on whether or not to bring a new product in is an understanding of what's causing disease, what's causing kids to become sick and in some cases die. And so understanding that rotavirus is a significant contributor to diarrheal illness in your country is, first of all, it's not a foregone conclusion. Many ministers of health don't realize that or haven't until recently realized that. And they won't believe it until they see data from the population in their country. Well, it just so happens that the international health regulations, which were signed in 2005, went into effect in 2007, place a significant responsibility on countries to be able to detect and report outbreaks of illness to the WHO in a timely manner, within 24 hours of the recognition of a public health emergency of international concern. And so it seems to me that there is an opportunity here as we assist countries to develop the infrastructure necessary to serve their surveillance needs, to support the IHR requirements, that same infrastructure will be very helpful to give us a better understanding as to what conditions are causing disease in poor populations, which will help ministers of health and ministers of finance to make smarter decisions as to what tools and technologies they should bring in to tackle that burden.
Thank you. We're going to do one more round. I was quite impressed by and cautioned by your remarks about how difficult it is to get big gains on the maternal and child health front because of the endemic obstacles. Where, as you look out and at the question of leadership and determination to sort of tackle these, the constellation of factors that come into play, where would you put your highest hopes in terms of leadership commitment and the possibility of seeing some significant gains in the next several years around the world? So just hold on that for a second. This gentleman right here.
Hi, I'm Mike Berkeley from USAID, and very, very interesting presentation. And I just think it's really innovative, a lot of the things you guys are doing. So, and I also think USAID can learn a lot from what Gates is doing. One question I had is if you talk a little bit about the role of the private sector in service delivery and if Gates is doing much in that area. The other thing is I don't know if you're going to make available any handouts or anything. If you could, that would be very useful. Thanks.
Thank you. Right here in front.
Ann Hendricks-Jenkins, Core Group. Wondering what you see the role of civil society in terms of health system strengthening in countries.
Thank you. John.
First, two kudos. First to our leader for creating the partnership with Gates that brings us all here. Steve, congratulations. And then second of all, to Rajiv, it's not easy to come to Seattle and be expected to develop a whole new area just when the economy collapses. Mm-hmm. So you're doing a great job. Today, what we've talked a lot about a number of governmental agencies that are involved. And I know you've thought about what I'm going to ask you, and that is, in this world we're in right now of limited resources, tell us a little bit about your thinking about corporate partnerships with Gates, corporate and involvement, much as the same way you've been talking about some of the governmental agencies. And then second of all is just talk a little bit about non-traditional government partners in meeting the challenges. Thanks.
Thank you. Right here.
Miriam Estrin from Brookings. You mentioned the importance of governance and health service delivery, but how do you, or what lessons have the Gates Foundation learned in delivering health services and doing surveillance and control in countries where governments have low political will and where you don't have government partners?
Those are good, tough questions. So on the issue of maternal and child health, you know one of the challenges here is that you haven't had a bed net equivalent for maternal health. Mm-hmm. Bed nets were a great thing that folks were able to hold up and rally support around. The guy from, I won't get into all the examples, but I think that it's been very tangible and it's been a rallying cry for everyone from business people to kids, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Brownies, to generate mm-hmm. funding for bed nets. The reality is that bed net is not sufficient to control malaria. You need to think about a lot of other things like indoor residual spraying, the use of artemisinin combination therapies to treat malaria. But the bed net is the hook. And we haven't had that hook with maternal health over the past 20 years. Now, the good news is that there is a lot of attention being paid now to MDGs 4 and 5. Sarah Brown, the First Lady in the UK, has taken a real interest in this issue. And she's become a bit of a champion, if you will, of maternal health. And I'm pleased to say that through her leadership and the leadership of a number of others that are working with her, and I think we're providing some financial support, I think we're starting to see the technical community land on a set of interventions that make up a basic package mm-hmm. that every mother should have access to when during pregnancy and when she's delivering a child. What we're now doing with that effort, which has gained a fair amount of momentum, spurred by a small NGO called the White Ribbon Alliance, is to add in a neonatal package to that. Mm-hmm. So you have maternal and newborn health being tackled together in a campaign to move that issue forward. And I'm very hopeful and optimistic that we'll see additional resources and more focus on the core set of things that we need to provide to moms and newborns to tackle this burden. With regard to USAID, we actually have great relationships with USAID specifically, and we look to USAID as well as doing some very innovative things in exploring the use of the private sector to deliver services. I think that there are real opportunities to expand the definition of the health sector beyond the public sector to include the true private sector and then also the informal sector. Now, in many developing countries. Now, the challenge there is ensuring that you have a sufficient level and uniform level of quality, of course, and that you have affordability in health services that are being provided through the private sector. And so we're looking at ways, approaches such as franchising and accreditation, looking at voucher schemes. One example I would point to is the Chiranjeevi scheme in Gujarat in India, where vouchers are given to women who are pregnant, and they can take that voucher, which is paid for with public funds, to any private sector provider to get services. Now, they're still working through the quality piece of this, and they haven't figured that piece out yet, and they need to. That's essential. But the point is that you are now tapping into a significant body of providers that just don't exist in the public sector, or the public sector is broken in some places and you need to rely on these other providers. So those are a couple of examples of how we think the private sector provides an opportunity, and we're in the process of exploring others as well. In fact, I think we're talking to USAID about doing a landscaping in this arena. With regard to the role of civil society, you know, civil society has been extraordinarily valuable in the HIV arena over the past couple of decades. And I think they've provided wonderful, you know, insights. They provided pressure on the system in order to tackle issues that weren't being addressed, access issues and otherwise. We have some civil society engagement on the health system strengthening issue. It's interesting. There is a bit of a, there are groups particularly focused on HIV care that are very concerned about the health system strengthening efforts because of the concern that it will take resources away from HIV in favor of health system strengthening, and I think we need to get past that sort of fear that there are going to be losers in this battle. I think we need to be smarter about everything we do, and I think civil society can help us there. I don't think we've had the same level of dialogue, though, with civil society that we've had on the HIV side yet. I can tell you, though, on the high-level task force, I'm in one of the working groups, there is a significant, I take that back, on the positive synergies effort, which is a WHO effort to look at the interface between disease-focused programs and health systems programs, there is significant civil society participation there. So I think you'll see that increasingly over time, but I think it requires some time to mature. But I think everyone that I've spoken to in this arena feels that there is an invaluable contribution to be made by civil society in the health systems debate. With regard to John, your question about corporate partnerships, and then you said non-traditional partners. When non-traditional partners being NGOs?
This would be like, maybe other entities that are
so the challenge for, and we're working through this internally, we're developing a private sector strategy inside the Gates Foundation right now. The challenge is that there are a lot of organizations out there that want to do something to support the call for creative capitalism, for instance, that Bill made last year. They come to us asking, you know, how they can help. Because we work through third parties, we don't actually provide the services ourselves. We end up being a bit of a matchmaker, if you will, trying to put those corporate interests together with governments and NGOs on the ground so that you've got a capability in the private sector, say a cold chain capability or the ability to a logistical capability. You match them up with an NGO or a government that needs that expertise on the ground. It's often not very scalable. It's pretty labor intensive, but I think there's significant value. We're just trying to figure out how to effectively tap into that goodwill. On the issue of using non-traditional partners like the military, again, I think that there are opportunities here. We haven't quite figured out how to capitalize on them. We're actually thinking through this with regard to the U.S. military and whether there are ways to use the logistical expertise that the U.S. military has to assist our partners to provide services more effectively. Not having the military deliver services, but to have that expertise inform the activities of partners that are there on the ground. So that's something else that's in its nascent stages.
Well, we've gone for a long time. This has been very rich, Rajiv. Thank you so much. Please join me in thanking